Cananians.
Someone once said to me, in auto repair, if more people swear by you than at you, you're ahead of the curve. And I really think that to be a true statement, because there's always going to be somebody you can't make happy.
Life is a highway.
The Car Doctor.
I'm trying to come up with logical reasons why we think it's the trends. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that's why I called you. Is this one of those situations where I get to go buy a new tool and buy a Ford IDS?
Nah, you don't need an IDS for this.
Welcome to the radio home of Ron and Anian, The Car Doctor. Since 1991, this is where car owners the world over turn to for their definitive opinion on automotive repair. If your mechanic's giving you a busy signal, pick up the phone and call in. The garage doors are open.
But I am here to take your calls at 855-560-9900.
And now, here's Ronnie.
Oh, is it my turn now? Gee, okay, then I guess I'll stop what I was doing. Well, actually, I was over here on the side while I was waiting for the show to get started. I was talking to Joe out in Pennsylvania about his 2017 Chevy Silverado. We were up here on Facebook talking. If you're out there, go out to the Ron and Anian Car Doctor Facebook page. And Tom very kindly puts up the video link or the audio link. If you're not listening to us live or you're not podcasting us, you can pick up the show via the Facebook feed during show live hours of Saturday afternoons, 2 to 4 p.m. East Coast time. Joe wrote in. He said, "Hey, Ron, I've got a 2017 Chevy 3500 with a 6.6 diesel. I live in Pennsylvania, mainly tow a 30-foot travel trailer. I have about 6,000 miles on the oil, but the oil monitor says I have 50% left. It holds 10 quarts of oil. What's a good miles to change this?" And, you know, we've been going back and forth over the last hour because while I'm talking to you, I'm talking to everybody. And, what I told him was, I said, for my money, I'd be using a synthetic. Joe also told me that he was using a semi-synthetic change at the dealer. And listen, I'm not knocking dealers. Dealers are just a repair facility. Because they're doing service on any vehicle doesn't mean they're using correct parts. We had a customer with a 2018 Dodge Durango that had a headlight failure under warranty. And they took it to the local Dodge dealer. The Dodge dealer put in an aftermarket HID headlight because the HID headlights are like $300 a piece for that truck. About 2 days later, the customer noticed he had a blue headlight on the left, which was the OE one, and he had a yellow headlight on the right, which was the aftermarket version, because that was the one that the dealer had changed, and they didn't use the same brand. They didn't use an OE lamp, and they didn't want to do anything about it. They said, our job is to fix the light, not necessarily make the colors match, which I thought was nonsense, and he brought it to us, and we got a $300 HID from the Chrysler dealer, Dodge dealer, and now he's got two that match. And, you know, he's in good shape that way. Just because it's the dealer doesn't make them right. The dealer is only as good as the people that are in there. So I then go on to talk to Joe, and I said, you know, it's got to be synthetic. Why not run synthetic? I don't know why we have semi-synthetic oil anyway. I don't see the point. Every engineer I talk to tells me that semi-synthetic oil exists primarily because of price point. You know, in my experience, I see the difference between semi-synthetic and synthetic of about $1 a quart. Spend the extra $5-6 in oil change. Put a full synthetic in it. Go a little bit longer on your interval. All right. Do the engine some good, because it's not just the length of time. It's also, you know, how good the engine is protected. And, I told Joe what I know. I said, you know, Joe, for my money, I'd be using a synthetic. Replied to him on the Facebook page. I said, I'm not sure what viscosity a 17 Silverado takes. I'd have to look that up. But I still like Shell Rotella 15W40 as a great diesel oil. And it is. Shell's really got it figured out. I mean, as far as diesel application, I see that oil used probably 80% of the time. It seems like everyone is using Shell Rotella 1540. He then asked me about oil additives or about fuel additives, I'm sorry, and I'll tell you what I told him. I said, you know, what do I always tell you guys about fuel additives? It's always changing. And there always seems to be a next better, best, greatest fuel additive out there. I like what Berryman does. I mean, Berryman, and I hear, you know how I know Berryman's got it going on? Is that when you, the listeners, and I've had more than a few of you write in or call me and say, hey, I called up Berryman's tech support. They actually put me on the phone with the chemist. How many companies do that? All right. Try calling the White House and say, I want to speak to the president. I want to talk to him about the... No, I can't go there. It's not a political show. I shouldn't say that. But you get the point. They're actually letting you talk to the front of the horse, which I think is a great thing. And I told Joe, I said I'd go to the Berryman website, look up, see what diesel fuel additives they have, and then work our way out from there. I think diesels probably need a fuel additive, depending upon what climate, what environment you're in, probably a little bit more in my mind than a gas vehicle, because the severity of application and what we're asking diesel engines to do, is so much more. And there are several critical factors that diesels exhibit versus a gas engine that just makes them more susceptible to things. And Joe wrote back, he said, "Hey, Ron, thanks. Any other issues known with that 17 Silverado?" And I said, "Yeah, sometimes there's trans and torque converter issues," which there are. The GM trucks, the Colorados, the Silverados, the 1500s, the 2500s, they're having converter issues. I've heard and seen some cases up to 100,000 miles, although it's up to 100,000 miles where the converters are failing and causing rough shifting and causing some other issues with the vehicle. And, you know, people are spending $5,000-$6,000 to get transits overhauled, but look at the price of a new vehicle, so it's not really that terrible. And I guess the point of this is, you know, I enjoy talking to you guys. I was distracted when we started this hour. I was talking to Joe on Facebook, but the Facebook feed is up, and it is working. It is doing what it's supposed to do. I want to talk about bad designs real quick, if I can, before I pull over and take the pause, before we open up the phones, which are getting busy at 855-560-9900. It's funny the little things that influence me and make me think, what are they doing here? I make coffee every day. When I get up before I leave the house, I make coffee for my wife. I don't drink coffee. They don't let me drink coffee. I was told not to drink coffee because, believe it or not, coffee makes me talk a lot. If you don't think, and I see in Tom roll his eyes, if you don't think I talk a lot now, boy, brother, put a cup of coffee in me. I will talk your ear off.
Please do not drink any coffee.
No, it's Tom. It's just amazing. I just, you know, it's like I could do my Cousin It impersonation and go on for about 3 days. So don't let me drink coffee ever. But I noticed the other day that, and we buy the same brown white bag. I don't even know the brand name, right? I just take this brown white bag of coffee that Susie likes out of the cabinet, and I put it in the pot and I make coffee. You know, I've noticed lately that I have to wrestle with the coffee bag to get it open. It's like an argument. Like, I want to open it. It says, no, I don't want to be opened. I don't want to be used. The other day, I had to actually take out a butcher's knife and cut the top of the bag open because the little serration, you know how they always put the little tear in the top of the bag so you can cut and tear? They got rid of that. And I started thinking about cars. And cars are like coffee bags, right? Somebody redesigned something, and we just accept it. We just accept that bad design. And I don't know why we do. I mean, I guess we have to in a way, right? We all have to drink coffee. We all have to drive cars. And I started thinking to myself, you know, how stupid are these people? They take something so simple as to open a bag of coffee. They take something so simple as an automobile. And I guess September has been like the month of stupidity, because I'm thinking about the cars where the alternators are under intake manifolds and there's drive belts that are inaccessible, and an alternator, it's been alternator month at the shop, and I don't know why. And I mean, back in the day, an alternator was $250 parts and labor installed. We're doing alternators for $1,200, $1,500. A Volvo was recently $2,000 by the time we took everything apart and put it together and found a few other problems. But it's crazy. It's crazy numbers. And it's like that bag of coffee. We just accept it. We keep buying those cars. We keep driving those cars. And it seems to me that we would have less problems if things were simpler. And I don't have the solution. Maybe we just all have to stop looking for ridiculous things. You know, I have one customer, Claudia, who keeps kidding me that someday she's going to get a Suburban or a big SUV. She wants heated and air-conditioned cup holders. And they're out there. It is available as an option. Why you would need that, I don't know. But it's a lot like that bag of coffee. I think eventually everybody will have heated and air-conditioned cup holders because, like coffee, everybody just seems to have one. Except me. I don't get to drink coffee because it makes me talk too much, which for some of you, you're probably going, thank God. 855-560-9900. Ron and Annie, the Car Doctor, coming back right after this without coffee.
And before we do that,
yeah,
I just want to say, you be quiet for a minute.
Go ahead.
Don't ignore your coffee. I want to talk to the listeners, you see, because I have to sit here. It's bad enough I have to look at Ron.
I don't have an off button.
To listen to Ron.
Wait.
Because I'm captive.
I don't have an off button.
And I'd really like the listeners to do me a favor and give you a call, because I'd rather listen to them. So please give us a call. We got a couple of open lines.
I'm ready to go. I'll be back right after this.
It on the wall so you don't forget to call for car advice done right. 855-560-9900. Now back to Ron.
Hey, let's get over to Bob in Binghamton with an 07 Chevy Cavalrado and some problems with a wheel hub. Bob, welcome to the Car Doctor. How can I help?
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure you must have had to deal with these one time or another. I've got two-wheel drive 2007 Chevy Colorado, and the left front bearing shot, and trying to get that hub out of there, and I'm almost to the point where I think I'm going to have to pull the spindle to get that out of there, because there's four bolts that go through the to hold it on.
Right through
but
the
those are
through the back of the knuckle, right, Bob?
Yeah, yeah, right. And those are through holes, so I can't use longer bolts and a nut or anything like that, because those are only through holes. The only ones that are threaded are the ones on the bracket for the brake.
Right, but what you could do is you could get longer bolts. First of all, understand those four bolts come off on the inside of the knuckle, and then that bearing and hub as an assembly is just sitting inside the knuckle. Those bolts retain it, and then the brake rotor is captured or locked into the bearing behind it. That's what we call a captured rotor. So you could, if you have access to an air chisel and some heat, you could, first of all, try soaking it with a Rust Buster. PB Blaster would be a good way to go, and let it soak, and then take those four bolts out, get something longer, hardened and longer, thread them back in, leaving approximately a half inch of gap between the bottom of the bolt and the back of the knuckle, and then take an air chisel and tap the head of the bolt alternately, make a cross, 1, 2, 3, 4, to spread the load out and try to pop it out of the knuckle that way. Because that's designed to come out. There's nothing else holding it in. That's not a pressed fit. Whatever's holding that in right now is rust. And if that doesn't do it as far as removal, then a little bit of heat's going to have to be required.
Okay, because I've looked at, I didn't want to have to, pull the whole, steering knuckle out, but, and hammer and chisel. I could try that. The other thing that I saw, I haven't done it, but I had looked on YouTube. Somebody took a couple 2x4s and cut them on each side and put it against the frame, and then used the power steering, and worked back and forth to try to push the thing off. But I don't think you can get at all four bolts, air chisel, the heads.
Well, I'm talking about an air chisel with a long, a good 12 to 14 inch long pointed bit. I'm not talking about something short. You need some running room here, and I would do that. That'll work. They also do make, you can find from certain tool manufacturers, a specific air chisel bit that is like a hollowed tube that will fit precisely over the head of the bolt, and the head of the bolt will have a washer built in, so it'll be a flanged bolt. Depending upon, you could find those, at various sources online, different bolt manufacturers, depending upon your thread pitch and what you need, and that will give you the ability to push on the flange using the air chisel. I've taken them apart like this before, Bob, so I know this works. I know, unless you've got something really strange or modified, that should get you out of the woods with this. But getting it loose is the first step. And if you have the time, I would really be soaking this with a good rust penetrant. But keep in mind, you have to get, this is a two-step process. You have to get that bearing and hub out, And then once you get that bearing hub and rotor assembly out, you have to disconnect the six bolts that hold that rotor to the backside of the flanged hub, and then remove that off, and then attach that to the new hub and bearing, and then assemble the whole thing back together.
Right. It's, you know, it's, that I could handle it was getting the whole assembly out of there.
Right.
That, you know, it's really stopped me.
Right. Well, if keep in mind, if you're in the salt belt, which Binghamton, New York really is, you may find that getting that rotor off the hub, you'll have to apply such force to the rotor that you'll distort it. So you may want to have a good source handy for another rotor just in case you need it, because you may not have anything left to press off or put back on, if you know what I'm saying. You may end up damaging it on removal. So it's happened. It's a 15-year-old part at this point.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Paul. You be well.
All right.
You take good care. Let's get over to Eric in Louisiana, 01 Chevy 1500, and see what's going on here, a suspension problem. Eric, welcome to the Car Doctor. How can I help?
Hey, how you doing?
All right, sir. What's going on?
I have a 1500 Chevy 2001, 104,000 miles.
Just broken in.
The first six... It's a cream puff.
Yep.
The first 6 years of its life, it was a company vehicle. Okay. I'm fighting wheel hop. I've changed the shocks. I went with Monroe Gasmatics, but the wheel hop reduced. Now, when I change the shocks, I exercise both the front A-arms. I couldn't see any visible movement in the ball joints or the A-arms, and I get wheel hop in the back. Now, I've measured the body. In the front, I have a half-inch tilt to the left side. In the back, I have a three-quarters of an inch tilt to the left side. And I'm suspecting that I have soft springs on my truck.
I'm suspecting that, too. When you say it was a company vehicle the first 6 years of its life, what does the company do? Are they... Don't tell me they sell.
I have no idea about that. I bought it from a little old man.
Got it. So it likely carried loads from what you're describing to me. The fact that its ride height is off. Yeah.
Yeah. They beat the tailgate to death on the thing backing into loading docks.
Okay. So it sounds like leaf springs in the back. Is this a coil spring or a torsion bar front spring truck?
Coil spring in the front, leaf in the back.
Okay. So it sounds like it's time for some springs, and I would suggest whatever you do, change front and back together. This way you maintain balance and equality so that all four are the same. Nothing better than starting with four equal springs.
That was my thinking because, I've looked at the body bushings, and it's like every time I hit a bump, and I have a friend down the street that has an 03, his ride's nice.
Right. Yeah, no, I would...
I took him for a...
Yeah, I would definitely start with springs with this, Eric, and work your way back out from there. You may find you want to change the shocks again because the spring rate may change the way the shocks react, but springs are first. So take good care and let me know what happens. I'm Ronanini, the Car Doctor. We're back right after this. Car Doctor, I'm reading an article this week, and I want to share it with you about Bridgestone. You have to stop and think now as we make the switch to electric vehicles. Everything that's going to change, and tires are going to change. Tires are going to be different. And a study came out this past week inside electric vehicles, insideevs.com is the website. Written by Michael Cantu. In anticipation of the automotive industry's shift to electric vehicles, Bridgestone will be shifting its focus to the electric vehicle segment of the market. The Japanese company made a goal for its future plans to have electric vehicle tires account for 90% of its new automotive tire sales by 2030. Now, how can that be my question was, how can they have 90% of their sales be electric vehicle tires if there's still going to be older vehicles running around? Are they just going to stop making tires? And I said, is this how we're going to get rid of the gasoline car? Bridgestone will stop competing with low-cost brands from China and South Korea as part of the shift that plans to end budget tire production for gas vehicles in Europe later this year. Europe will be the first market to see assembly lines converted to accommodate electric vehicle tires. Similar manufacturing conversions will take place in Japan, the U.S., and South America down the line. I don't know what the difference is. Tom's asking me a question. What's the difference between an electric vehicle tire and a gas vehicle tire? I don't know. Here it is. Actually, it says right here, Tom. The Nikkei Asia report states that tires for electric vehicles are 20% lighter because they use less rubber and other materials and face 30% less resistance. So it's a more expensive tire to manufacture. Bridgestone has already made gains with legacy automakers that have electric vehicles in production. It supplies Volkswagen's ID models with tires. And in 2023, the company aims to increase supplies to European brands and launch retail sales for customers. Bridgestone also has plans to supply tires to Fisker's upcoming electric SUV that's supposed to enter production late this year. It also wants to manufacture tires for electric trucks. The Rivian R1T was the first electric truck to enter production this year. The Hummer EV and F-150 trucks are due for production in the year, early next year, respectively. I read those stories, and then I read this out of Detroit. This is a late story. This story's getting to us late. This is out of Reuters from June 29th. You glide out of the Tesla showroom in your sleek new Model 3, satisfied you're looking great and doing your bit for the planet. But you have to keep going, the article says. You'll have to drive another 13,500 miles before you're doing less harm to the environment than a gas-guzzling vehicle. That's the result of a Reuters analysis of data from a model that calculates the lifetime emissions of vehicles, a hotly debated issue that's taking center stage as governments around the world push for greener transport to meet climate targets. The model was developed by the Argonne National Laboratory in Chicago and includes thousands of parameters from the types of metals in an electric vehicle battery to the amount of aluminum or plastic in a car. So, do we have any answers? Are we just fabricating all of this, or I just don't.
I'm still puzzled.
It seems like it's a big push, right, Tom?
Why would a tire for an electric car be lighter and use less rubber? Doesn't that mean you're going to go less miles?
Well,
between tire changes?
I guess it can be lighter or different construction because the weight of the electric car isn't the same. And
well, yeah, in a way that makes sense, but still, if you're using less rubber, that sounds to me like the tire won't go as far. And
one of my concerns is we're making, all we do now is read stories about these big changes that the industry is going through. We're going to, have different tires, and we're going to have different assembly plants, and they've actually stopped. And I've spoken to a few people on this. They've actually stopped any future development of internal combustion engines beyond the year 2035. That's it. No more. So we're not investing anything further. We've taken it as far as we can go. We're just writing it off. We're saying we're done. We're going to go electric. But there's all these challenges, I'll use that word, in the way of, charging, battery life. Where are we going to get the material? I still go back to that article. I've got it here somewhere in studio that we read a couple of months or a couple of weeks back that talked about Afghanistan has the world's largest supply of lithium battery material, making it the equivalent of Saudi Arabia and its oil supply. So Afghanistan will become the new Middle East. Of course, I won't get into the politics of that, what just happened there, but it just makes you wonder what's really going on. And there's just something there that just doesn't make any sense. But yet we're making all these drastic changes to accommodate something on a maybe. I said this to somebody the other day, half tongue in cheek. I guess maybe when the aliens show up in November to take over, then they'll show us the way to do electric vehicles. And then again, maybe they turned around when they were halfway here because they said, "Who wants to go to that place? It's crazy."
In case you're curious, it's Idiot Test, and it starts now.
And it could be. I was thinking of, I was thinking of doing bumper stickers. You can't fix stupid, right? I figured I could probably sell them if I could get the production down to 50 cents a piece and sell them for a buck a piece. All I got to do is sell a million. You think you'd sell a million bumper stickers that say you can't fix stupid in the world we're living in? So you wonder. Argonne's greenhouse gases regulated emissions and energy use and technologies model is now being used with other tools to help shape policy at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. There's a bunch of guys that make sense. And the California Air Research Board, another bunch of guys that make sense. The two main regulators of vehicle emissions in the United States. Cord Kelly, principal engine system analysis at Argonne, said making electric vehicles generates more carbon than combustion engine cars. Let's read that line again. Corey Kelly, the principal energy systems analysis at Argonne National Laboratory, said making electric vehicles generates more carbon than combustion engine cars, mainly due to the extraction and processing of minerals in electric vehicle batteries and production of the power cells. But estimates as to how big that carbon gap is when a car is first sold and where the break-even point comes for EVs during their lifetime can vary widely depending on the assumptions, Kelly said. The payback period exists then depends on factors such as the size of the EV's battery, the fuel economy of a gas car, and how the power used to charge an EV is generated. I don't think there's any good answers here. I really don't. I question it all. Let's pull over and take a pause. 855-560-9900. Ron and Andy, the Car Doctor, coming back right after this. Welcome back. We're on Name the Car Doctor. You know, the one thing I love about all you guys out there listening is your responsiveness. We're talking about electric vehicles a little bit this hour, along with some other things. And someone sends me an article, deserted factories show how China's electric car boom went too far. I haven't even had a chance to read this yet. Let's do this on air together. So it says, this came to us from financialpost.com, commodity/energy vehicles, yada, yada, yada. Deserted factories show how China's electric car boom went too far. And visitors to Byton Limited's website are greeted with color-saturated images of shiny electric cars gliding along manufactured street. Those paying a visit to the automaker's factory in Nanjing, eastern China, may be less impressed. The plant is modern, huge, gleaming under the hot summer sun, but there's total silence. Production has been suspended since the pandemic began. It's a similar situation across town at Borden Motors. The article continues. Weeds dot the factory's perimeter, and there's a court notice posted to the main gate announcing the electric car maker's bankruptcy. Huh. In many cases, they were lured into existence by provincial governments dangling cash and other incentives to make Beijing's dream of turning China into an electric vehicle powerhouse a reality. Local authorities helped manufacturers set up factories that promised jobs and development. You know, there's some really big names attached to electric vehicles, it seems. There's just an awful lot of money out there that is just, they're all clamoring for position, right? They all want to be the next Henry Ford, so to speak. And let's see. Alarmed by unbridled investment in the sector, referencing electric vehicles, and the bankruptcies and the zombied factories that came with it, Beijing is applying the brakes. We have too many electric vehicle firms, China's Minister for Industry and Information Technology reportedly told reporters September 13th. Mergers and acquisitions will be encouraged as the market needs to be further concentrated, he pointed out. The government is also looking at setting production limits at setting product. Let's read that line again. The Chinese government is looking at setting production limits for the electric vehicle sector. People familiar with the matter told Bloomberg News this month, being September 2021, with provinces unable to go green light new projects until surplus capacity comes online. Resources will also be channeled into a few select electric vehicle hubs. And that's part of what I keep thinking, that we're trying to do too much too fast. The article then goes on to say there are 846 registered automobile manufacturers in China, and more 846 registered automobile manufacturers in China, and more than 300 of them churn out new energy cars, loosely defined as electric or plug-in hybrids. The vast majority are names unrecognizable. In 2020 alone, the country added new production capacity of around 5 million units, about four times the actual number of electric vehicles sold in China. Last year, according to the regulators, almost half that capacity wasn't in use. I like the idea of an electric vehicle. I'll tell you where I thought they were taking electrics too far. And maybe this is a little off topic for cars, but what the heck, we're so far off topic today, it doesn't matter. I went out to buy a snowblower this week. I didn't tell you my snowblower story, did I, Tom? I went out to buy a new snowblower this week. And first of all, if you need a snowblower, buy it now, because A, there aren't any, and B, you're probably not going to see one unless you buy it now. I went into my local little the Sharp Shop here in Midland Park, New Jersey, where I always go, and I saw Nicole behind the counter, and you know, I need a snowblower. She said, "Well, we don't have any." And usually, you know, most of the lawnmower places have their snowblowers or stuff there a couple of months early. They'd have it by now. It's September, and she said, "You can go online to Toro. I like Toro. I think Toro makes a decent machine." And, you know, buy it there, they'll ship it here, we'll put it together for you, because right now Toro has supply at the factory, but not here. And I thought, God, where have I seen this before? This is like the car industry. I had someone this week tell me that they found, now listen to this story, they found a late model Honda CR-V that the dealer wanted. It's a $15,000 Honda that the dealer wanted $20,000 for. And I went, what? And you've got that backwards. You mean it's a $20,000? She says, no, it's a $15,000 Honda that they'll sell to us for $5,000 over sticker, you know, what they've got it on the lot for, because there's such a shortage of cars. Wow. Makes the snowblower story look pale in comparison. And she said, however, they told me that if I was trading in a car, they could give me a real good price on the trade, because no matter what's wrong with it, they're going to fix it to sell it. So I just keep thinking to myself, my God, what are we doing here? It's going to become a seller's market. And you know what? I think you're going to see the better repair shops continue to be busy and stay busy, and the ones that haven't won't. But it's going to be interesting, very much so, that the way the market is changing and evolving, and technology is going to shoot itself in the foot, or shoot the industry in the foot, because they're expecting too much. I wonder what's going to happen 6 to 8 years from now, because 6 to 8 years is the sweet spot for the automotive aftermarket. For, you know, think about the age. As a shop owner, I can tell you the age of the vehicles we tend to see a lot of. We're fixing 13s, 14s, 15s, and 16s, right? Well, 6 to 8 years from now, because of the lack of sales of the 20s and the 21s and 22s maybe, what's going to happen to the automotive repair market in 6 to 8 years, when all of a sudden there isn't that glut of cars to be fixed because there wasn't that glut of cars sold? And it's going to change things. It's going to affect the balance sheet of many businesses in the future. Not to be the sayer of doom and gloom, but it's just something to watch out for. It's going to be kind of interesting. So just be aware. By the way, I did get a snowblower. I ordered it direct from Toro. They're going to ship it right, and they'll assemble it and drop it off. But if you're looking for a snowblower, it's going to be a pretty neat trick this year, from what I understand, that they are in short supply. 855. Yeah, Tom, you were going to say something? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I did that last year with an electric snow shovel from Toro. They didn't have it at the local store, and right, I ordered it online. It showed up. It's just like they sold it to me.
All right. And maybe, you know, they're
so
doing that.
The local guy got his buck, and,
right?
You know,
yeah. And maybe they're doing that because it's easier than trying to put it. You know, you put everything on the East Coast, and then the guy in the middle of the country wants it. You put it in the middle of the country, the guy on the East Coast wants it. So it's just easier to ship it direct like that. But I'll tell you what, there's certain things that we're not going to see full supply of for at least a year. So it's going to be interesting. 855-560-9900. The Car Doctor's coming back right after this. Welcome back. We're on the Car Doctor. I noticed the phones were a little quiet today, Tom. It must be a nice day here in the Northeast. Everybody's out cruising around the country, I guess.
Well, that and high school and college football's up.
Oh, yeah. We're getting
people
back
maybe
into
out
that.
Of the games.
So either that or we're going out of business. Maybe we don't have to be here next week. Can we get next week off? They probably
that'd be great.
Us.
I don't have to see you.
They probably miss us.
No, you were talking about parts shortage and stuff before. That extends into places like broadcast. I mean, There are still some stations that use transmitters that take power tubes. And power tubes, this kind of sounds kind of odd, but power tubes can be rebuilt. Right now, it's a guess if you're going to get a good tube, and if you can even get one, because they can't get the raw materials.
Well,
and what they do get is wrong.
Right. Well, and the raw materials thing, it's killing everything. And I wonder, I'm reading an article about how Indiana is going to have self-charging roads for vehicles. And I'm reading the contents. There's solar panels. There's a receiver coil. There's a transmitter coil. It's going to create a magnetic field. It talks about as the 21st century rolls on, we've all had those one or two moments when we see some new technology and innovation really comes home to roost in our heads. Maybe for some, it should have been the self-driving feature of the Tesla or smart home systems. But for motorists in Indiana, that moment may come by way of a shiny new wireless road. While range and battery charging times are getting better every year, it's still the most limiting factor when it comes to the purchase of an electric vehicle. The Indiana Department of Transportation has decided to tackle that by burying electrified wire coils that create a magnetic field along the road surface, mimicking the way wireless charging stations for tablets and phones are designed. I want to know, so Tom, we're going to be driving on top of a magnetic field?
And I again ask, how safe is that for a human being?
Right. What's the? I mean, didn't they tell us that having our cell phones too close to our heads years ago was cancer causing? You know, Tom. To be continued. You just got to ask yourself what's really going on. Till the next time, it's Ron and Tom, and we're both reminding you: good mechanics aren't expensive; they're priceless. See ya.